Accession number 18625, Reel 1.
Dr. Boydell, Reel 1, where were you born, please?
I was born in the country near Lancaster in a place called Bay Horse.
Which year was this?
That was on the 8th, that was in 1925.
Did you grow up and have your schooling near Lancaster?
Main school to which I went was in Blackpool. A school called Arnold School in Blackpool, which is still going. Doing very well as well. And it comes out well in the league tables.
And is that where you were in the early part of the Second World War?
I was, yes. I was at Arnold School in Blackpool, and we had an army corps there. It was called an office, OTC, Officers Training Corps, in those days. And we took an examination called Certificate A.
What kind of training did you get at school in the army?
Just on a range, on a shooting range, with a rifle range. We had every week we had an afternoon where we drilled. Then we sometimes went off to camps and things. And just basic infantry training, really. That's what it boiled down to. And
was it any use to you later on?
I suppose the rudiments of map reading were taught, but I didn't need to have to know how to map read, but. It's always been useful in life generally, but not in any sense in the army.
And you were telling me earlier that you were in the Home Guard?
Yes, I was in Lytham Home Guard, and I was issued with an American 300 rifle and 30 rounds of ammunition, and the idea was that if the parachute is landed, we shot our way through to Lytham Hall, where the Home Guard assembled. I don't think anyone would have gone there, actually. But it was funny comparing it with the program that's been on the television. We had someone who was a captain who was just like Captain Mannering, and we had a second lieutenant who was just like. Monsieurier, do you know him?
Yes.
You face him? You
yes,
see
he's
him?
The sergeant.
He? He's the sergeant, yes, that's right.
And did you personally think that the Germans would invade?
Yes, I did at one stage. I can remember when the Germans actually invaded Russia, and I was in the kitchen in our home in Lytham St. Anne's. And then I realised that we were going to be safe after that. In that what they had taken on was probably going to be so great that at least they'd been diverted from us. But at that time, we all thought they would invade, yes.
What did you suspect might be the outcome if they did invade?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. I couldn't anticipate that they would kill us all or do anything like that, but in retrospect, obviously they would have carried out their anti-Jewish policy here, wouldn't they? And I think that would have come in a lot. I don't think I gave that particular point a lot of thought at that stage of life. And,
what about the training you had with the Home Guard? How did that compare with school?
In a way, it was just an extension of it. At school we'd been in First World War uniform with puttees and things. In the Home Guard we went into second. Initially we didn't have uniforms. We were just in with an LDV on our arms, a little armband. That was Local Defence Volunteers. That was how it started. And the name was changed to the Home Guard, and we were eventually properly armed, and we were also properly in proper clothing, proper soldiers' clothing. So it, I don't think there's an awful lot more that I can tell you about the Home Guard. We used to go on various schemes into the country, and I can remember crawling along ditches and having the thunder flashes going off and things like that. And
were they mostly young or elderly?
No, a lot were quite elderly. There were several young ones. I was about, I think I was about 16 at the time. And then there were also quite a lot of, certainly 60 plus people in it, who'd either, who'd been in the forces in some way or another, you know, in the past, in previous wars, and in the First World War it would be. Yeah. And we had, there was a barracks at Lytham, and we used to go there. I think we went once a week. And there we had ordinary parades and drilling and that sort of thing, the usual thing that you get with them. I was never really very soldierly, I don't think. And
were you in any bombing in the Second World War?
Well, no. Lytham St Anne's has a well-known church, marble church, called the White Church, and that is at the estuary of the River Ribble. And when the bombers came to bomb Liverpool, they used it as a marker, because, as you know, the Ribble and the Mersey are almost parallel and very near to one another, and it took them away from the anti-aircraft guns of Liverpool, I think. But I think there was bombing in, I remember once some bombs dropped in Lytham, and I can remember the noise now, and I think we were in the local church schoolroom. We had a very nice church minister who looked after the young people, and he had a young people's league, and we used to meet every Tuesday night. I think we were there, and it was a tin building, and when I say tin, I mean corrugated iron, and I can remember it shaking, but that was all, nothing else, and I don't think we had any more experience of bombing or anything of that sort, no.
Did you ever think the Germans might win the war?
I don't think so. But in retrospect, that sort of thinking at that particular time was not logical, because I think there was a very good chance that they could have won the war. And having read various things since, one realizes just how very good their troops were, and perhaps their equipment was far better than we were taught, because, of course, propaganda does mislead you in so many things, doesn't it, in so many spheres.
Did you ever listen to Lord Haw Haw?
Yes. Oh, quite regularly, yes. Quite regularly, yeah.
What was your impression of him?
Well, I always regarded him not seriously, I think. And although he did... They obviously, what was obvious was that they had got information going through, because there was quite a famous pub called, I've forgotten the name of it now, but it was at a place called Wheaton, where there was a big army and also an RAF in the area. And Lord Haw Haw referred to this pub one night and to the landlord by name and threatened that they'd blow it up. So I can remember that.
Did it get blown up?
No. We used to go to it.
Did you listen to Churchill's speeches?
Yes, 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 I did. My father would listen to them, and my mother, and we did listen to them, yes.
What effect did they have on you?
Well, I think they were very much morale building, as I remember it at the time. I think they had the effect that they were meant to have, and to, you know, maintain a defiance against the Nazis. And but I was most impressed by Churchill's speeches. I'm sorry that he was at the end of the war, that he lost his power and things. But there we are. That's the nature of democracy, isn't it?
Did you go to university after school?
Yes, I did. In those days, we didn't take A levels in those days. We could go to university on what was called matriculation. In other words, you got a certain standard in ordinary school certificate, and then they would take you in. And I didn't know what to do. I had thought about doing accountancy. I had thought about doing medicine, and I became much more keen on medicine. And then I felt a little bit conscience-stricken that I wasn't actually in the war or going to do these things, you see, going to do something that was probably reserved. So I made inquiries and thought about going into what was called the Y scheme. The Y scheme was a scheme to train as an officer in the Royal Navy. You know about that? And
I think I've heard of it.
Yes, probably heard of it. And the other thing I had thought I would do was go on aircrew. My parents got to know about this. And I think they thought, well, I wouldn't last long, because my mother and father had had quite a lot of aircrew billeted in the house. And my mother took them in and looked after them. And they said, you'd better get off to university and do medicine. And so I did, and that was reserved, of course, through the war. And one felt a degree of discomfort, I think, being reserved, especially when things were bad in wartime, and especially when one's friends were killed, and this sort of thing. Anyway, I made up for it afterwards. But I think I was quite glad to go to Korea, really, afterwards. And in a way, it sounds a bit odd, but there we are.
Can you tell me the main events between, it must have been 43, leaving school, and going to Korea in 1950?
Yes, it was 42 we went to the university, because you could go at 17 in those days. Main events in...
Just the main events to bridge the gap to Korea.
I see. Yes, well, the main events really were the university career, where we, of course, on the one hand, most of the time spent doing medicine, but it was obligatory to be in the senior training corps, and one had to go down, I think it was almost, sometimes it was a day a week, and it was a 2-week camp a year, I think, to do military training. And if you didn't do this, or if you tried to avoid it, you were just kicked out. And then while in the senior training corps, I did certificate B, which was, do you know about this? Certificate B is it was really an infantry officer's training that one could do, and it consisted of, there was a physical part when you had to do, you could go 10 miles in full kit in 2 hours, that sort of thing. And the other really involved examinations in map reading and infantry training, various things of that sort. So I got both Certificate A at school and Certificate B at the university, but never thought that it would be of any value. I don't suppose in a way it was, because I went on to the sorted house jobs afterwards, and after the university, and then into the army. I was called up to national service.
When would that have been?
That was 1949, late 49, I think. Went down to the southeast of England, Crookham, and round there, and we had a doctor's squad. Which was a hodgepodge of various doctors. Some were interested in the army, some were not. And I found the army very fair to us, in that they asked us all where we wanted to go, and I think nearly everyone got the posting that they asked for. Except that the posting most people wanted was in Jamaica, and only God knew one chap who got that. And I only met one man who was dissatisfied with his posting, and he was a recently married man. And he was an anaesthetist, and they posted him out to Egypt, and he was a bit upset about that. The rest of us were single. And I asked to go to the Far East, because I just wanted to have a look at it. But never thought that there'd be a war or anything like that out there. And we went out to on a ship called the Empire Orwell, and we went to Hong Kong. And the first thing that happened was that I was posted up to the British Military Hospital to work there. This was a British Military Hospital on the island of Hong Kong. And I was there for a while, and then I was posted out to the Middlesex Battalion.
What kind of work did you do at the military hospital?
At the military hospital, it was just what was called a general duties medical officer. Really, anything that came along. And anything that cropped up, really. It was quite a cushy posting, really. It was comfortable, and we had servants to look after us, and I had a nice servant called Ah Chen, and when I got up in the morning, and the bath was drawn, and the socks were laid out, and the underwear was laid out, and everything. So it was all very cushy, and made you feel what it would be like to have a butler.
But you had a commission in the RAMC by now.
Yes. Oh, yes. Well, you were commissioned straight away. You became a full lieutenant straight away, and after a year, you were automatically made up to captain.
And can you tell me about going to the Middlesex, please?
Yes. It was just one did so long in the hospital, I can't remember how long, but one just got just told one day, well, you're going to go and be the medical officer for the Middlesex Battalion, which was out at that time in the New Territories in Hong Kong, on the border. It was a place called Lo Wu, L-O, two words, W-U, I think. And I remember one could go up to the border. We were warned not to go across because Mao Tse-tung's troops had just come up to the border at that time. While we were there, they came. And I suppose it was Chiang Kai-shek's troops, the nationalists there before. And they had obviously retreated. The communist troops came up. And we were a bit afraid that they'd come over the border. But as you know, they didn't. But we were warned not to cross the border. You could go up to it. It's just like a line. The Chinese went across. But I think if we'd gone across, there would have been trouble. It would have been... And there was a wire fence all the way around to presumably to have some form of... I suppose it was just to show where the border was. Because the border went out into the country, of course. What else can I say? There was at this camp, we lived in a house, big house for the officers in, what was its name? Ebenezer House, that's what it was called. And we all lived there. Andrew was there, and Andrew Mann was there, and all the officers lived in this place. And we had our camp at a place called Bee's Stables, and I can remember that to get to that camp, you had to go on in your jeep or however you went, alongside a big bamboo fence, and it was a bit dangerous because you didn't actually see them not as you went up, but we knew there were a lot of cripe there, and you know, the snakes, so I had to be careful, and there were bamboo snakes in the bamboo. But no one was ever bitten, and I can't remember anyone coming in. And my work there was largely inoculating, treating people with athlete's foot, and it was being a general practitioner, if you like, put it that way, in the army. And occasionally listening to the tales of woe that the men would bring in, and often ignoring young officers who came in to tell me that so-and-so was swinging the lead. You see, they were probably right.
Was there much lead swinging?
I think there was no more than at any other time, but I think you tend to get more lead swinging, more boredom, when troops are not in action. This is commonly recognised, isn't it? And if troops are involved in something that is life-threatening, then a lot of attitudes change. I think that attitude to the officers changes, and particularly if the officers are recognized as being highly competent. They may have been regarded earlier on as being strict disciplinarians and pretty unreasonable and pretty nasty, but then when the troops realize that they are in fact efficient and life-saving in battle, which they can be, then I think their attitude changes. Can't bring any names in, but I know some officers now who are revered by them. And they, I think that when we go to the reunions, and I think that the men realize that the probably their lives were saved by their competence of these officers. Am I rattling on too much?
No, not at all. How were you accepted as a national serviceman into the battalion?
Oh, I found them extremely kind and very, very nice indeed. And because I wasn't a very military man, and I felt that perhaps the national servicemen would be regarded as rather a nuisance, you see, by the regulars. But that wasn't the case. They were very, very nice indeed. But of course, you see, a lot of the other ranks were national service anyway, perhaps 50%, I think. So the integration seemed to be very good. And as I understand it, and from what I have read since Korea, the regular soldiers regarded the national servicemen very highly, I think. Yes, I think so.
Were there any special health problems in Hong Kong?
Well, yes. Malaria was one. Benign tertian malaria was quite common. I had a ward in the hospital, in the British military hospital, before going out to the Middlesex, in which we had two main diseases. One was dengue fever, which is called breakback fever, and it's pretty nasty. I've had it myself. And that's a malaria-born illness. And then, of course, the malaria is mosquito-borne, I mean. And they were the main illnesses, I think. And then there were the usual run of diarrheas and things, and one just had to treat those. For my part, I got a very bad attack of sinusitis when we were out with the battalion near Lo Wu, and I had to go into hospital to have sinus washouts, and I was in hospital for quite a long time there. This was before going out to Korea. And I remember the ADMS coming round shortly before we went to Korea, before we knew that we were going, and he said, "Well, how are you? Are you all right? Are you getting better?" And I thought he was concerned about my welfare. I suppose he was. But he also wanted to know, was I going to be fit to get cracking, inoculating the battalion, I think, which I then, when we got the orders to go to Korea, I had to inoculate the battalion. I remember going with my sergeant to get needles, and I don't think we got many. There must have been about 3,000 or 4,000 inoculations to do, and I think we only got about 20 needles, which was not enough to do the job properly. You could do it and re-sterilize them, but by the time you got to the last one, I think it was a bit hard on the troops that they had to have those things stuck in them. So there was a certain shortages. Other illnesses, the other main illnesses were probably venereal diseases. The main ones, of course, were gonorrhea. Syphilis was fairly rare, but gonorrhea was common. And this was a funny thing. You again, one wouldn't like to refer to the troops, but the troops I had to look after did not seem to go after the prostitutes to the same extent that ones from other battalions did. And if I had to take sick parades for other battalions, one would often find, particularly on a Monday or a Tuesday, that every second person coming into the regimental aid post, probably had been exposed to or had caught gonorrhea. And of course, these were a criminal offence. It was a what did they do? You could go on a charge if you disabled by one of these sexually transmitted diseases. And some officers wanted the names to be put up on boards so that the names of the people who were suffering. But I must say, I rather objected to that, and I can't remember it happening. I found that when these things cropped up, I found the army authorities very reasonable and understanding of these things. Just one or two more fanatical people would probably have done it. Yeah. I thought it seemed to me a bit unreasonable, because if you were to put, if a man got gonorrhea and you put his name up, well, next week when some other chap's got it, he's not going to get it treated, you see. And this was so it wasn't a very sensible attitude to take.
Could you clear it up quickly?
Well, no, one had to. Well, yes, it was cleared up quickly because they had penicillin, and the particular strains at that time were very sensitive to penicillin. So the people were just sent straight into hospital. They went into Kowloon, and they were back in no time. In those days, one shot of penicillin, one shot of crystalline penicillin, it just cured gonorrhea. This was the. But then, of course, as time went by, more and more resistant strains arose. But of course, more antibiotics came.
Now, coming back to Korea, you were inoculating the battalion for going.
Yes.
Can you take me on from there?
Yes, surely. Well, I had to inoculate the battalion, and the principal illnesses for which I inoculated them were typhoid and paratyphoid. As a matter of interest, paratyphoid is no longer given today, because I think it's ceased to exist as an illness. But typhoid is still given if people are going abroad. So we had typhoid and paratyphoid in a combined injection. Tetanus was the other one we had to do. And typhus, this was the other one that was at risk. And of course, in those days, smallpox, which has now, again, smallpox has now ceased to exist. You may know that. And oddly enough, and I don't know whether the regulations have changed, but the only country that still demands an international certificate of vaccination against smallpox is North Korea. I think whether they've stopped that, I don't know. But that was the only country left which demanded it. So those were the main illnesses against which we had to inoculate them. Then we all went on an aircraft carrier called the Unicorn, and that went straight to Pusan. It was a direct trip. And there was the Unicorn, and there was a cruiser which took the Argyles. I think that was called the Ceylon. And the Argyle, the first battalion of the Argyle and Sutherland Highlanders went on the cruiser, and the Middlesex people went on the Unicorn. I remember passing Formosa, and there was some scare about, so there was a submarine scare at one time, because they wondered whether there was any risk from Soviet submarines to us. But we had destroyer escort. Though I think there was a New Zealand destroyer, and there was a British destroyer escorted us all the way to Pusan. I remember arriving at Pusan, and there was a Negro band on the quay. And by God, it was smart. They marched up and down, and they played the St. Louis Blues. You've probably heard about this, have you? And I've got a picture of them. I've got some photographs of them. And they really were